Hi, this is a much bigger crowd than I anticipated. Bear with me, I get really nervous. How many of you have worked with Miricom switches before? Just a show of hands. Whoa, wow, okay, that's like 7 or 8, okay. And how many currently use Miricom gear? A couple, yeah. How many people here are HPC people, so you know about supercomputing? And okay, a lot of my talk is gonna be pretty boring for you guys, I'm sorry about that. I used to work at the Leadership Computing Facility at Argonne National Laboratory. It's in beautiful Chicago, Illinois. And I helped deploy and administer Intrepid, which is a supercomputer that was number 3 on the top 500 list when we put it together and submitted the LIMPAC results. I was the only network admin, and it was a pretty crazy time in my life for a lot of reasons. We had a lot of issues with our networks, specifically the Miricom network, and that's a lot of fun to go over, as long as that stuff doesn't happen to you, you know? But in my opinion, by studying these things, we can learn a lot. I want to answer a few questions as we go along. You know, why did it take us so long to get things working? I'm going to show you some fun graphs. It really did take a long time to get everything up and running. What problems did we run into, and what could we have done better? If you have any questions, you know, I'm totally into that. If this talk is hard to understand, that means I'm doing it wrong. A lot of these recommendations are common sense because that's the nature of the beast in this case. Just as a disclaimer, the things that I'm saying here do not represent Argonne in any way. The Argonne Leadership Computing Facility is basically it takes grant money from the DOE Insight Program and then delivers node hours, and we hope that those node hours are going to be used to do really great things. A leadership class computer, an HPC computer, is a really big, fast computer. Nowadays, that means that it's massively parallel. You know, instead of like, we can't make one CPU faster anymore, so we'll just strap 40,000 of them together and try to make them all communicate. Sometimes that works really well, and sometimes it doesn't. It depends on what kind of job you're trying to run or what you're trying to accomplish. So Intrepid is an IBM BlueJean P supercomputer. IBM, I don't know if it makes any money for them, but are there any people from IBM here today? Good. So I don't know if they're making any money on this, but they design these like new revs of supercomputing technology every few years. The one that we used is called BlueJean P. It was brand new when we designed the machine. Each node sits on a card that's about as big as like a couple of wallets put together or something. A node contains, it has a CPU on it, a 4-core CPU. It has some RAM locally, but it does not have local storage. So anything that happens on the supercomputer, if you want to save your results, you have to go over the network. If you want to boot a node at all, you have to go over the network. Nodes can talk to each other over the networks that are built into the BlueJean P architecture. They're right in on the back of the racks. But in order to get to storage, they have to go over the Miricom network in the case of Intrepid. One crazy thing about BlueJean that's different from a lot of clusters is they have to boot every single time they run a job. So when someone submits a job, they allocate nodes, which is this long booting process, and they pull a kernel and they pull all their software basically over the Miricom network and over another network as well. There are massive amounts of disk storage. Now, I put 5 petabytes here. I think the actual number is somewhere between 6 and 7 petabytes. I don't remember. Of raw disk. But that translates to about 5 petabytes of usable storage. We have some storage over NFS, but most of it is over GPFS and then our own product called PVFS. Intrepid also, other than the BlueJeans stuff, includes a visualization cluster. It's 100 nodes, and those are more like commodity Linux nodes, and they're used to make visualizations. Basically, they have these GPUs that are strapped to them, these like one rack unit things. And there's also a really big tape library. It's somewhere, it's like 18 or 20 petabytes of tape. All of those things talk to each other over the Miracom network. So the moral of the story here is if the Miracom network breaks, nothing works. This is a picture I made of, how does that look? This is a picture I made of the Miracom network's position inside Intrepid, and you can see, this isn't really what it actually looks like, but it's pretty close. BlueJeanP, every one of these circles, I don't know what that stands for, but BlueJeanP has 40,000 nodes or so. 640 of them are specifically for I/O, and those talk through the Miracom network to everything else. The file servers are attached to big data direct networks things. And data transfer nodes are run grid FTP. They can send data sets back and forth over the WAN. And the Viz nodes are on top there. But again, the Miracom network's role is really critical inside Intrepid. It's not the only network. this is a picture that shows some of the other networks and was color-coded. I don't remember why I made this. Thanks. Yeah, I like it. There's a much prettier one, but it's in the wrong orientation, so I couldn't use it. But the Miracom network is on top there. So Miracom, if you're not familiar with them, they're this high-performance switch vendor. Their switches are totally stupid. The only thing that they do is they pass packets back and forth extremely quickly. We bought 10 of them. We thought we were going to buy 9, but we ended up buying 10. And we connected them in a full mesh. So they have full bisection bandwidth, and that means that for every host that's plugged into the network, there is another link to the core. Every link is 10 gigs. And when I got there in the middle of 2007, it was intense. It was like crazy to me, and it still is, that I was going to be in charge of 2,000 10 gig cables. File servers and visualization nodes connect using CX4 copper, and they run a driver. They have a MirrorNet NIC. The BlueJeans stuff only has 10 gig Ethernet, so that has to use this Ethernet to MirrorNet conversion chip that sits on the switch. And then quad fiber MTP-ended cables are used between the edge and the core switches on MirrorNet, and you'll learn about those real soon. This is what the edge switch looks like. This is actually the nicest looking one. Of all the edge switches. This is like, we didn't know when we bought this stuff, when we designed it, that we would need a lot of room for the cables. So these are in regular server racks. And so everything's pretty tight in there. Every orange thing that you see is a quad fiber ribbon that goes back to the core. And every blue thing you see is a connection to a BlueJean I/O node. This is one of the core switches. It just has the quad cables. And these at the bottom, are spine cards. If you know anything about a CLOS network, this is a five-stage CLOS. The edge is the first stage. This is the middle three stages, and then another edge switch is the fifth stage. MirrorNet is supposed to be a source router protocol. That means every node that wants to communicate on the network has to have a map, because it's responsible for putting the entire route of the packet into the packet header before it sends it out. Then all the switches do, again, they're really stupid, that switches don't participate in routing or anything. They just take a packet, look at the next hop, spit it back out, and that's how they get really low latency. Hosts either run a mapper, or they depend on their 2Z chip to give them a map, and the mappers elect a master. Whenever a link goes away, the map needs to be recalculated, and that causes, like, much like an old-school spanning tree reconvergence. We saw MirrorNet break in a bunch of ways. I'm going to go over that in detail in a bit here. But we had two big issues that affected us for quite a long time. The first issue was about 6% of the Ethernet to MirrorNet ports. We depended on about 700 of them. were affected by this random death issue where they just drop off the face of the earth, and they would not seem to come back. So the only way we could recover that is by unplugging the cable and plugging it in somewhere else. And then the second issue, which was much more damaging, about 15% of the core links needed to be manually disabled due to faulty quad fiber transceivers. And then in the end, we had to replace 1,007 of them, which is a lot of work. Issue number one, you know, an IO node drops off the face of the earth, then every job that tries to run using that IO node can't run because it can't boot every node. So that did not affect us nearly as much as the second one, simply because when the quad ports failed, they didn't just fail. If they would have just failed, the network could route around them. But since they didn't just fail and instead they would corrupt every packet that went through them, the entire network would have problems until we manually turn that port off. I think I already said a lot of this stuff. Even if a node has booted and it's running a job, if the MirrorNet network goes away or starts becoming unstable, it can't save its data set, so it might as well not be running a job. This computer was so expensive that I can't even begin to explain how much. I mean, if we lose, this thing has 40,960 nodes, right? So that's, if we lose the computer for an hour, that's 4 years and 9 months of processing time on like a single CPU quad core system. If the MirrorNet network goes away, all this gear that we bought is useless. And when the MirrorCom network breaks, it's really hard to figure out what's wrong, or at least it was then. It probably still is now, because MirrorCom switches are really stupid. They don't have a CLI. they don't log to syslog. They don't support SNMP. They don't do anything, really. They have a web interface, which, you know, if you like sitting around and clicking, is a lot of fun. But it's really hard to glean a lot of information when you have like 4,000 different switch connections. This is the timeline of those two issues and how long they affected us. The 2Z firmware issue, which is issue number one, affected us for about, from the time we noticed it, the install started in October 2007. There was about maybe 9 months of stuff in there. But then like the other issue affected us for like 2 years, man. It was terrible. And we went production here. We meant to go production here. We went production here, and so the users had to put up with like totally crazy network horribleness for a really long time. So the first lesson that I learned are that vendor relations should not start with a production issue. And I didn't really learn this completely until I left my job there. But if the first time you're contacting your vendor is to say, "Oh my God," you know, like, then you're screwed. You're not going to get to the end of like your, like, it's going to take you 2 years to develop a good relationship with them. You know, you're already like on a bad foot with them. So if you hire people who like don't have social skills or something, you're not gonna get anything done. You know, it's like rule number one. And if it hurts to hear that, I'm sorry. In my opinion, great vendors are great because they're staffed with great people. So you should get to know those people. More than just the sales team. There are some vendors, I'm not going to name names because some of them are probably sitting in this room, but like the sales team are awesome. They'll come at you and they'll sell you stuff and then they disappear. And nobody wants to talk to you after that. And lesson number two is pretty simple here. You have to know about your systems in order to debug them. So if you wait until you have a production issue to learn about the systems that you bought, it will be really difficult to get to the end. And lesson number three was have realistic expectations. We got a good deal on our MirrorCom gear, and we should have taken some of the money that we saved getting that gear and bought more people. Instead, we just had like a couple of people who had time to look at it, and that was probably a bad plan. I think if we could do it over again, we would have had like this huge staff of network engineers helping code something other than a web interface for those switches. Also, the more bleeding edge your systems are, the more you can expect to go wrong. And lesson number four, don't pay them until it works. In our case, because of weirdness with our contract, MirrorCom ended up getting paid by our reseller before they shipped a single piece of gear. So we had very little leverage when this thing didn't work, trying to get them to fix the issues. If it was a software issue like the first issue we had, They would fix it. If it was like replace 1,000 pieces of hardware at your own expense, they didn't want to have anything to do with it. Let me show you some more fun graphs. So this is the number of quad fiber core ports that we had to manually disable. There's a blip in the graph here, and that's because instead of swapping all of them out, Miricom wanted to see how many they could shake out of the system over time. So we went and measured every transceiver by hand and replaced only the ones that measured out of spec at that time, which gave us a little bit of time, and then they started going bad again. This is the number of hours that we basically lost on our supercomputer because of only the quad ports issue. This funny thing, so the way I measured this is I had thresholds that I set up, and I set up a lot of, I made like a script that would decide which periods of time the network probably was not stable at all and shouldn't have been used. This period of time right here, this like funny thing right here, that's because we had a period of 72 days straight where the network couldn't be used. No matter how many ports went bad during that time, we couldn't catch them fast enough. Wow, there's water down here. Thank you. But in general, the trend, you know, I mean, it was probably, Miricom wanted to shake things out of the system. That's fine, you know. It would have taken us quite a long time, though, to get to plateau, you know. And we almost got over 9,000. Over 9,000! OpenOffice does not come with a frowny face. It only comes with a smiley face, so. But over 2 years, we lost 375 days of compute time. I mean, we lost tens of millions of dollars of compute time. And the earlier compute time is worth more because your supercomputer is worth less over time. This is the number of boot failures that are correlated with the aforementioned clusters of error periods. It's a whole lot. We had boot failures for a bunch of reasons, but this is a third of them. And in my opinion, I don't really like to run a network where a third of the failures let me back up a little bit. I have some more fun graphs. I want to make sure I get to the graphs. That's when we discovered the cause of the issue. We discovered it ourselves because we did the troubleshooting ourselves. That's how long it took Miricom to get around to actually agreeing to fix the problem. Again, because our relationship with them was very poor. That's the first graph I showed you, and that's when we discovered the cause. We basically lost twice as many hours as we should have because of bad vendor relations. So lesson number 5 is a good one. I think if you get one thing from this talk, it should be this. Don't let your vendors talk through you. We had storage issues because we had network issues. And then we had disk controller issues because we had network file system issues. And none of those vendors wanted to talk to each other. Instead, they wanted to tell us things to tell the other vendors. So instead, what we ended up doing was we held a regular phone meeting like twice a week with the vendors. But you should do it every day. I mean, you should do it every hour, you know, if it's a serious enough production issue. And once we started doing that, the vendors wanted to cooperate. I mean, it was not like, you know, I think people don't want to like be adversarial with each other. It's just that by default, that's how it gets sometimes. And then yeah, we did some troubleshooting on our own. Troubleshot? Is it really? That's terrible. We ended up writing. When I say we, I ended up writing this switch events collector because, you know, we didn't really, other than the web interface, we didn't have a way to gather issues. We tried to catch broken links before they caused downtime, but a lot of times we didn't. But I'm really proud of that. It was like this big thing that I wrote in Perl. It was fun. Lesson number 7 is you should come to an agreement in advance about how much failure is too much failure. I think if we had done that as part of our contract in the first place, it would have been a lot easier for us to get our parts replaced. Xilinx made the bad batch of transceivers, they were actually, it's funny, we actually used, we had two different manufacturers of transceivers, Xilinx and Avago, And every single one of them had to be taken out of the system and either reprogrammed or replaced entirely. All the Avago ones had to be reprogrammed. Our relations with Avago were awesome. I mean, those guys, like, they told us. So we had this software issue on the Avago transceivers where after 500 days or so, they would just stop working. They would, like, overflow some log that they had internally, and then the firmware would just stop. So Avago contacted us, and they said, hey, man, we know you haven't run into it yet, but you have this issue. And they flew three guys out, and we helped them take the transceivers off the boards, and, like, we reprogrammed them right there in the machine room, and we put the boards back in, and it was awesome. With Xarlink, since we were using IBM as a middleman to Miracom as a middleman to Xarlink, we never even reached them. They refused to talk to us. My last lesson is stay positive. I know a lot of this stuff is, like, negative, and this has been pretty good for me because I get to, like, exercise my demons about my last job, but if you celebrate your victories, that goes a long way. I wrote, like, a few nice emails, and it really did go a long way. The longer you deal with the same issues on a system, the lower morale is going to get. So at least make it look like you're making progress. I think that's really important. Again, it's, like, about social skills. I can take questions now. Thank you for listening, by the way.
So you did this great lessons learned. Do you know if Argon did this great lessons learned? So they didn't repeat this?
You know, I don't know. I wrote this paper and presentation stuff while I was working there. And I don't know. I don't know if any of the people on my team, a lot of us left, you know. And that's how they learned the lesson. But I don't know if anyone on my team even read the paper, so I don't know. Probably not. But they should. If you guys are going to watch this video and get mad at me, but,
you know. Hi, Hugh Brown from University of British Columbia. How much of your lessons learned, particularly dealing with vendors, requires being present and able to set conditions during the negotiation, as opposed to being sort of a lower layer technical team who's not directly involved afterward?
Probably about 50%. You know, I mean, in my opinion, you should do acceptance testing of any gear that you're going to purchase before you pay for it. You know, and you should not skimp. You should not cut corners on your acceptance testing. I think also, before you get the gear, you should definitely come to an agreement with the vendor about how it's supposed to work. But then after that, a lot of it is social skills. A very small amount of it is technical, and hiring more technical people to code some stuff for you is good, if that's what you need, especially in the bleeding edge. But, like, it's probably 50-50.
Hi, very unique talk. Congratulations. So, I'm not very familiar with high performance computing. Was this, let's say, a very particular instance? I mean, other HPC centers have very similar problems with you guys, or not?
I don't know. This was my first experience in HPC, and I do have, you know, since a lot of us left, some of us went on to other labs, and so I look forward to hearing from them about whether or not they're going to run into the same kinds of things over the next deployment. But for me, I don't know. You know, I went on to do other things. So I work at Bright Cove in Boston right now. It's, like, a really cool place. I'm very happy to be there. So I get to see, like, web scale. And that's a different world, you know.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. I noticed one of the issues you ran into was one that I've learned previously, which you didn't have up there, which is don't buy from vendors that only have web interfaces. It will cause you all sorts of hell. Make sure they have some sort of API.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And make sure that you can monitor your gear and maintain it before you buy it. I mean, I think that's really important. Yeah.
So how did you end up deciding on the Miracom? And were there alternatives or ones that you saw after the fact that you would have gone with?
So from what I understand, the reason why we went with Miracom is because we needed like 2,000 ports of 10 gig, and nobody else was willing to do that for the price that they could do it for. I mean, it was like a very, very, very big difference in price. Nowadays, you might be able to do it with another vendor, but like, I mean, even now, 10 gig is not supported the ways that I'd like to see it supported everywhere. So.
In retrospect, was that very, very big difference in price more or less than the millions of dollars of compute time lost?
Less. I mean, that's my opinion, but yeah, in my opinion, it was less, yeah.
So I was wondering, did you attempt to find a commonality amongst, you had all these parts failing, did you try to find a commonality on, you know, all of these were one batch of serial numbers, all of these were, you know, some particular thing, or did the discovery of the common bad chip just happen by accident?
That was us. It seemed like over a couple of months I disabled like 8 links, and then over the next few months I disabled 41 links. So by the time I disabled 41 links, I went back and looked and tried to move cables around and see what the problem was. Was it bad cables? Was it bad transceivers? And then when I found a set of 10 transceivers, I opened them up and looked at the serial numbers and stuff, and they were all from the same manufacturer.
Do you think you might be able to solve that type of problem faster in the future if you start making a concerted effort sooner in the process? Or,
yeah.
You know, I mean, is there a point at which you have to say, you know, is this something that we can, you know, that has a common factor, I guess? At what point do you have to say that?
Yeah, my experience with troubleshooting was not nearly as good then as it is now. And I think nowadays I would probably, in a matter of weeks rather than months, find out what the issue was, or at least have some ideas. I kind of depended on the vendor to do that work, and that's bad. Don't do that. You know, like, you have to do your own troubleshooting, yeah, especially on production stuff. Yeah.
Thank you.
Did the problems that you were having with, because you were talking about positive relations, do you think the issues were with, you know, project managers and Miracom's managers, or were they between, like, technical people?
I think, you know, in hindsight, I think it was a difference between what our expectations were and what everyone else thought that we should have been expecting. I also think that depending on resellers rather than going directly to each vendor was probably a bad idea for us. We did not get very good service through resellers compared to what we needed to solve these problems. Thanks again. Thanks.